case this morning is Clemens versus Walls and Ms. Griffin.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Colleen Griffin from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent in this case. This case is here on review of the district court's decision granting habeas corpus relief to petitioner on two bases. First, the district court found that petitioner was deprived of his due process right to a fair trial by the introduction of gang evidence against him. And secondly, the district court found that petitioner was deprived of his right to the effective assistance of counsel at sentencing. Initially, as a preliminary matter, I need to correct a statement I make in my brief. And my brief regarding the first issue, the fair trial issue, I state that the district court found that petitioner was denied his Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial and 14th Amendment right to due process. While that is how the petitioner framed his argument as a Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial, it is, of course, the Fifth Amendment which encompasses that right, and the district court never made a reference to the Sixth Amendment in that regard. Regarding the first issue on which the district court granted relief regarding the deprival of petitioner's right to a fair trial, it is the respondent's first position that this claim is procedurally defaulted.
Could you explain in conjunction with that how you distinguish our not so long ago decision in Rittenhouse against Battles?
Yes, Your Honor. Regarding, in this case, the claim before the post-conviction court was a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. And the claim in...
Well, with the description, though, I mean, I guess that's what we need to get to. Yes, you're right, certainly, that he called it a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. But
in
Rittenhouse call for going beyond that?
No, and I don't believe so, and this is why. The district court, or the post-conviction court's ruling in this case merely states that the claim was frivolous and patently without merit. In Rittenhouse, the habeas claim before this court was a violation of due process based on jury instructions, and the state court claim was ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to object to the instructions. However, this court found that the state court was obviously on notice of the due process claim because the state court undertook a very extensive analysis of that due process claim in its decision. We don't have that in this case. You can't say based on the finding that the claim was frivolous and patently without merit that that's enough to show that the post-conviction court would have been on notice that it was really dealing with a Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment claim of denial of a fair trial, as opposed to the claim that was actually presented, which was, of course, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
So it would be the state's position that you need some evidence from the state court that it considered the claim that the person is now attempting to present, whether or not the person was clumsy as a pro se petitioner describing it or not, but you need that extra evidence?
Without anything else, which I don't believe there is in this case, I mean, in deciding whether a procedural default can be avoided based on a fair presentment issue, this court must consider the facts of each case in totality. And in this case, there's just nothing to suggest that the post-conviction court should have been on notice that this was a fair trial due process claim as opposed to what was actually presented before that court. And again, the cursory nature of the trial court's decision in this case doesn't give us anything else to base that.
And the appellate decision in this case, in that situation, was just a summary.
Correct. It was a Finley motion on the part of appointed counsel. And then, too, petitioner made a Finley response to that, wherein he just talks about ineffective assistance of counsel. Throughout the entire post-conviction proceedings, all the way up to the petition for leave to appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court, they talk to unprofessional, incompetent, and ineffective assistance of counsel. They cite to Strickland versus Washington. It's a Sixth Amendment claim of ineffective assistance of counsel from the post-conviction petition all the way to the Illinois Supreme Court.
Was there any line, was in the disposition in the Illinois Appellate Court, was there a discussion, any discussion at all of the merits of the case?
No, there was not. It was strictly your typical Finley granting of the Finley motion. And the district court in this case relied solely on the fact that the post-conviction petition referred to the prejudicial nature of the evidence, of the gang evidence that was admitted before the trial court, and said that that would have put the post-conviction counsel on notice, or the post-conviction court on notice of, that this was a due process fair trial claim. But as we point out in our brief, a Strickland claim necessarily requires a petitioner to demonstrate how he was prejudiced by counsel's ineffectiveness. If petitioner did not talk about the fact that this evidence against him that counsel supposedly did not object to or failed to make an offer of proof about was not prejudicial, he would have failed to even present a Strickland versus Washington claim.
But he never got that far. I mean, it seems to me that's, my sense of it was, is that if the state court really thought that it was looking at a Sixth Amendment claim, there are two parts to a Strickland analysis, as I'm sure you're well aware. One of them is defective performance, and the other is prejudice. And you have to show both in order to make a Strickland claim. And this terrible gang evidence that the Illinois Appellate Court on direct appeal was so very critical about the conduct of the state prosecutors about was objected to throughout by counsel. So if you're thinking of a Strickland claim, then where's the defective performance? You know, what's the lawyer supposed to do? You know, race up and muzzle the judge? I mean, the lawyer was objecting. So I would think the Illinois Appellate Court on post-conviction, if it conceptualized this only as a Sixth Amendment claim, probably never even thought about prejudice. As you point out, we don't know.
Well, then that could be very well true. But again, just the fact that it was raised in the post-conviction petition doesn't show that it was a Fifth Amendment claim. He had to discuss prejudice. The discussion of prejudice was before the court on direct appeal. Unfortunately, the petitioner procedurally defaulted from that particular analysis by the appellate court. The fact that the post-conviction court never had to get to the prejudicial nature of the evidence doesn't mean that this was raised as a fair trial claim. It just means that, yes, they may have decided it based on the first prong of Strickland, but that's how it was raised by the petitioner, and if it could be disposed of on that basis, they didn't have to reach the procedural nature of the evidence.
But, of course, the district court, in footnote 13 of his opinion, thinks it's pretty clear that the post-conviction petition is raising, you know, that the state post-conviction petition raised a problem with the fairness of the trial, and specifically the prejudicial impact of the gang evidence on the jury. Are we supposed to just disregard what the district court said?
Well, that is our contention before this court, that this was not fair presentment of that claim that the district court found. Again,
is our review of the district court's decision on this point de novo, in your view?
I believe that the review of the district court's order on a legal issue is de novo. However, in this court, the district court failed to give any deference whatsoever, as required under the AEDP, to what the appellate court found regarding the prejudicial nature of this evidence. And I know that's
not quite what we're saying. I mean, the district court looks at what was before the state court and interprets it. And the question is whether we should just disregard that altogether and reinterpret it on our own, de novo. And I'm speaking here specifically of the state post-conviction petition, or whether we owe any deference at all to what the district court did.
No, I believe that this is a question of law to which this court doesn't, that the district court's decision deserves no deference. Whether there's been fair presentment enough to overcome a procedural default is an issue of law, and this court should review that claim de novo. And again, this footnote 13 goes to the district court's belief that the statements made in the post-conviction that the prejudicial impact of the gang evidence of the on the jury would have necessarily put the post-conviction court on notice that this was a fair trial due process claim. And again, as I said before, the petition, the post-conviction petition, states trial counsel is ineffective in failing to object to the evidence. His memo cites to Strickland versus Washington. Again, all the way up to the Illinois Supreme Court, he talks about Strickland versus Washington and prejudice is a necessary component of a Strickland analysis. If there's no further questions on that point, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Norwood? I'm sorry, Mr. Pekin.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chad Pecron, and I represent the petitioner appellee. In this case, Amari Clemens.
Rarely
Very
enough.
Rare to do the red brief in a case like this.
That's true. And we appreciated Judge Castillo's ruling. First, I'd like to address the same correction that counsel made to her brief. It is, of course, the Fifth Amendment that creates the due process right to a fair trial. However, certain elements of the right to a fair trial, such as the right to counsel and the right to an impartial jury, are created also by the Sixth Amendment. And I believe that was the source of some of the confusion.
Let me ask you a merits question here, beyond this procedural default thing. Is it your position that no gang evidence should have been admitted during this trial, or some, and here it was too much?
Well, Your Honor, there's two ways to look at that. First of all, the only evidence that was really directly relevant to the issues in this case was possibly some of the issues of gang hierarchy, which would have established some sort of a motive, such that petitioner had shot this individual in order to move up in the gang. However, that assumes that there was some relevant evidence of gang membership that was ever actually admitted. The only evidence of gang membership that was ever put forward in this trial was Officer Bluer's testimony related to petitioner's tattoos. There was no evidence, however, that petitioner ever had his tattoos at the time of the shooting. The shooting occurred 2.5 years before the trial, and petitioner was arrested over a year.
You don't deny that this was a shooting of a gang. The victim was a member of what it was, a gangster disciples or something. You don't deny that, do you?
We don't deny that. To make the record clear, the victim actually was never shown to be a member of any gang, but it was shown. It is likely that the shooting was related.
Certain way or something like that, doesn't it?
The shooter was wearing his hat in a way that would have indicated his membership in the P-Stone gang, and that was the rival gang of the gangster disciples, so it is likely that the victim was shot in the belief that he was a member of the gangster disciples.
So if that's conceded here, that this sort of gang membership, rival gang membership, was a factor that went into the shooting, then where do you draw the line as to what evidence is admissible on that and what isn't? And when you get federal habeas review here, seems like the judge is just doing a lot of weighing, and perhaps as a trial judge, if he was sitting in state court, would have kept some of this evidence out. But now we're on federal collateral habeas review, seems to be doing a lot of second-guessing of these evidentiary rulings on what's going to be admissible and what isn't.
Well, Your Honor, the evidence that was introduced at trial went far beyond any sort of motive evidence that would have related to advancing in a gang hierarchy. There was evidence put in about drug dealing, that gangs engage in drug dealing. There was absolutely no evidence that this shooting had anything to do with drug dealing, as this court's aware. Drug
Isn't
dealing.
That pretty much common knowledge, though. I mean, it's not anything that would shock the jury to hear that gangs, rival gangs, get into turf battles over where drugs are going to be sold. That's pretty much common knowledge, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, perhaps it is common knowledge, but the fact is that this evidence was introduced at the end of the prosecution's case, and it was basically Gangs 101. Officer Bluer's testimony Officer Bloor knew nothing about the specific fact of this crime. He didn't know anything about the petitioner other than the fact that he apparently 2.5 years later had tattoos that might identify him as a member of this gang. Otherwise, his testimony was...
You don't deny that he was an expert, though, on gang structure and that sort of thing, do you?
Well, we don't make the argument here that he was a gang member or that he was a gang expert. However, as Judge Castillo pointed out in his opinion, there was not a lot of... Officer Bloor admitted that his expertise was not the basis of scientific study or anything like that. It was basically just based on his own self-taught experience as a member of the Chicago Police Force.
Well, that's still valid, isn't it, for an expert?
It certainly could be. However, they did not present anything to back up Officer Bloor's basis as a gang expert other than the fact that...
Well, then you'd want more evidence about gangs to back it all up, wouldn't you? Did they call 4 or 5 policemen or gang members to testify about what gangs did?
Well, Your Honor, we're not disputing that Officer Bloor, in a proper situation, would have been entitled to testify as an expert. However, we believe that what he testified to in this case just went far beyond anything that was relevant or necessary to this case.
See, that's Judge Evans' question is, if you can have some come in, and I think you agreed, I won't push you on that point, but that there should have been, there could have been some gang evidence that is related to structure, to put this murder in some context. The question is there on the continuum, where do you stop?
Well, Your Honor,
the belief is that he went too far.
First, we wouldn't concede that any of the evidence should have been admitted because, as I stated earlier, there really wasn't any evidence of gang membership other than the fact that he had these tattoos 2.5 years later.
Weren't the eyewitnesses, or at least the witnesses, gang members? Admitted gang members? They're already in jail, I think, weren't they?
Two of the eyewitnesses were in custody at the time of trial, awaiting sentencing awaiting trial on various other drug-related
members of the rival gang, though, right?
Yes, they were members of the gang.
They were DDs, not P-stones, right?
That's right.
I thought your point was that by the time all was said and done, particularly having him go through the humiliating exercise of disrobing in the courtroom and having somebody go around pointing at him like a piece of meat was pretty demeaning, especially without linking it to what happened at the time. But I wanted to go back to this procedural default issue because I'm not sure, however we may come out, and the marginal effect of the extra gang testimony that came in, whether we can do this. Because as I understand, you're not making an argument of actual innocence in the sense that the statute would entertain such a thing. So that doesn't overcome procedural default. As your opponent points out, unlike in Rittenhouse, we don't have a clue from the state courts here that they thought about this fair trial issue and considered it. So what are we supposed to go on?
That's correct, Your Honor. We really don't have anything from the state from the state post-conviction courts to determine what sort of basis they founded their decision on.
And
However, he didn't
take it all the way up to the Illinois Supreme Court back when he was on direct appeal, which is a problem that we now know under O'Sullivan against Ferkel.
That's correct, Your Honor, but we would reject the position that the respondent has put forth here that fair presentment should somehow be interpreted on the basis of what the state court says in its opinion. That would unfairly punish the petitioner in this case for the fact that the state court saw fit not to write a formal opinion in this case.
But how do we know the state court realized this issue was being put on the table? Don't we, at a minimum, need some clue from that, from the state court itself? Because otherwise, without that evidence, the whole idea of fair presentment is undermined.
Well, Your Honor, if it was the case that in a situation where the state post-conviction courts wrote cursory opinions such as this one, that habeas review could be somehow skirted, I think that would be a very unfair precedent to set for petitioner such as Mr. Clemens, who...
Well, I agree with you, but if that... I mean, if we were here talking about their resolution of the Strickland issue, of course we wouldn't have this problem, because that's what he said he was presenting to them, so we know they knew, because he said so. I mean, here you're one step beyond that, where he describes a set of facts that might lead to one or more problems, and I think you're asking us to look at that set of facts almost as though we would on a 12b-6 and imagine any claim that might have been asserted, but I'm not sure that's the law.
Well, Your Honor, first, just to clarify a point that respondent made, petitioner's original post-conviction petition did not cite to Strickland. The petition did say that counsel was, at least in this argument, petitioner did not cite to Strickland. Petitioner said that counsel failed to make an offer of proof, but you have to remember, petitioner was advancing pro se in his post-conviction petition. And if you really look at the substance of what petitioner argued in his post-conviction petition, it was clear that what he was arguing was the result of this prejudicial evidence on the jury.
So who characterized it as a Sixth Amendment claim to begin with, then?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Who's the one who said this was a Sixth Amendment claim? Didn't he say my lawyer didn't do certain things?
He did say that his lawyer should have kept this evidence out, which is essentially the gist of his argument. However, the lawyer clearly, if you look at the transcript, there's over 40 pages in the transcript of where his lawyers were trying to keep this evidence out. Clearly, that couldn't have been the point that petitioner was trying to make here. The point petitioner was really trying to make was that this gang evidence was extremely prejudicial. If you read some of the language in petitioner's post-conviction petition, he says that the evidence inflamed the jury's passions and that it was completely irrelevant. And it's clear that what he was doing was saying that this evidence shouldn't have come in because it inflamed the jury and that it prejudiced the jury against him. Part of the problem that the respondent alleges is that, yes, prejudice is a factor under Strickland. However, the court would have had no reason to do a Strickland analysis in this case because counsel did at trial attempt to keep this evidence out. Counsel put forth substantial efforts to keep this evidence out. That couldn't have been the argument that petitioner was trying to make. Petitioner was clearly arguing the inflammatory, prejudicial nature of this evidence.
But we don't want to put too fine a point on a pro se petition and what he thought his lawyer should do. And even though his lawyer may have objected, he may have felt that didn't do it correctly.
Well,
I mean, that's the problem. In just observation more than a question to you, but I mean, it makes it difficult to know.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, we don't dispute that petitioner's post-conviction pleading could have been more artful. However, if you read it, it's very clear what he's contending. He contends that Officer Bloor's testimony was put in by the state to prejudice the jury against him.
So who first characterizes this as a Strickland claim? Is it the court? Is it the state? Somewhere along the way, we come to the point that what he was raising on post-conviction was about effectiveness of counsel. Who's responsible for that?
Well, Your Honor, there were other arguments that were effective assistance of counsel, which we haven't really talked about today, but that we do raise, and one of which, the sentencing issue, habeas relief, was actually granted by the district court. Now, on the post-conviction, on the response to the Findley motion, petitioner does cite Strickland, and he does make, however, I believe that was in response to some of the Findley arguments that were made by appellate counsel, arguing that these were without merit. If we could move to the sentencing point for just a moment, because habeas relief was also granted on that. It's important to note that on the sentencing point, the burden that petitioner faces is a lot lower. Petitioner only has to show a reasonable probability that the result would have been different had counsel performed effectively. There's no evidence on the record here that counsel ever contacted petitioner's mother prior to the mitigation, prior to the sentencing proceeding. Now, petitioner was facing a very serious crime. He had been convicted of a very serious crime. And counsel had to put forth some efforts in mitigation to try to alleviate the sentence. However, counsel didn't even bother, apparently. And the only evidence we have on the record on this point is the affidavit of petitioner's mother stating that she was not contacted by counsel, and that had she been contacted, she would have personally been willing to testify as to petitioner's rough upbringing. What counsel, trial counsel, did in this case instead was to basically point the finger at petitioner's mother saying, it wasn't petitioner's fault, his mother brought him up this way, which is an extremely different argument from having petitioner's mother come up and say, I really didn't do a very good job of bringing petitioner up. And the effect that that had on the judge was apparent by his comments in sentencing. I see that my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Griffin?
Very briefly, regarding the procedural default issue, the post-conviction petition identifies this claim as Issue 1. Petitioner was denied his Sixth Amendment right to the effective assistance of counsel at the trial level as a result of trial counsel's failures in the following errors. Then he has A, B, C. This particular claim is encompassed under his heading D. While that petition doesn't specifically cite Strickland versus Washington, the petitioner filed a memorandum of law in support of his petition, which does cite Strickland versus Washington. So the Strickland versus Washington test was before the post-conviction judge. Regarding the merits of this case, I'd like to briefly point out again, the district court in this case found that the decision was contrary to and involved in unreasonable application of clearly established federal constitutional law. Obviously, this could not be, the contrary clause too could not form a basis for the grant of habeas relief. The district court never found the state court employed the wrong test. So what this court would have to define was that the state court evidentiary ruling regarding the gang evidence was an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. I believe under this court's recent decision in Hardaway, that burden simply cannot be met. At the trial court level, the petitioner conceded that some of this evidence was relevant, the rivalry between the gangs, the boundaries between the gangs, the false flagging, and the rewards given to gang members if they shot another gang member. He objected to the hierarchy, history, criminal dealings, and display of the tattoos. The appellate court found some of the evidence objectionable, but found that most of the evidence regarding gang evidence was relevant, and found that anything that was admitted that was irrelevant was harmless beyond any reasonable doubt because of the overwhelming evidence against the petitioner, which included an eyewitness, an unbiased eyewitness who testified who was standing right next to the victim when he was shot. The district court in this case just undertook a retrial of the entire case. It redetermined the credibility of the witnesses in this case. Petitioner refers to the fact that the district court didn't believe Bloor should have even been allowed to testify as an expert. That was never an issue before the trial court. This was just something the district court believed on his own. The district court believed that this evidence was really introduced to pander to the fear of the jury as opposed to showing the motive for this crime, which was why it was admitted into evidence. The district court stated that Bloor's testimony was to prove petitioner was a black keystone killed the victim, therefore petitioner shot the victim. That was not why Bloor's testimony was introduced in this case. It was the identity of the petitioner was shown through the witnesses who saw him shoot the victim. And again, petitioner refers to the fact that the district court found that because Bloor's testimony was introduced at the end of the state's case in chief, that showed that it was introduced just to prejudice the jury. Bloor's testimony could not have been presented anywhere but at the end of the state's case in chief when it was shown that petitioner was a gang member and it was petitioner shot who shot the victim. If Lohr would have testified to first, all of the problems that petitioner perceived regarding his testimony would have been true. The jury would have been confused as to why this officer is even testifying as to gang evidence when it was not proven that this was the motive for the crime yet. Regarding ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to have the petitioner's mother and brother testify as to his bad upbringing, this is not a situation where this evidence was inherently mitigating, and counsel, in fact, did make an effort at sentencing to contradict the prosecution's case by the evidence that it did admit at the mitigation stage. If there's no further questions.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Again, thank you to Mr. Pecron, as you were appointed counsel in this case, I believe, and the court appreciates your efforts and the fine quality of the work. Thank you.